So, briefly recap kind of what was the highlight. Here we were looking for a transformation. So, first of all, so we're looking for transformation. I'm already using complex coordinates. Which I think with the tutorial yesterday, you must have become familiar with how to go from real to complex coordinates. So I make a change of coordinates from, in general, from omega as a function of z and z bar. And we notice that transformations, you start with a metric. Okay, essentially, just that if omega is holomorphic, so just a function of x, then this induces a conformal transformation because this is the same as dw bar is dw dz times dw bar dz bar dz dz bar. So just rescale the metric by this conformal factor. Okay. So that's fundamentally why we're looking at the holomorphic transformation. These are transformations that leave the form of the metric that just rescale the line element by some factor like that. Okay. And then we discussed what are the peculiarities of two dimensions in terms of what are the tensors in two dimensions and how do we write them in terms of how many z and z bar components it has. And we essentially define the notion of a primary that transforms under this conformal transformation like that. Where we emphasize that now the information about the conformal quantum numbers are encoded in H and H bar, which are two real numbers. And which you can relate to the more familiar spin and scaling dimension in a very simple way. So essentially, the scaling dimension of this operator is just H plus H bar. And the spin, so how it transforms under a U1 transformation that rotates Z and Z bar. The spin is just H minus H bar. And that's, I think, essentially where we stopped, if I remember correctly. And now I want to move on. So any question before I proceed about this? Modulo the fact that we're using complex coordinates as opposed to the usual Cartesian coordinates, real coordinates, that we used in all our lectures before. This part of this analysis is essentially identical to what we did before, except that now we're writing it in terms of complex coordinates. So conceptually, there is nothing really new. Of course, what's really new, and that's why we're studying this, is that the space of the set of conformal transformations is infinite dimensional. And that will put a lot of restrictions on the correlators of the theory. But other than that, other than the fact that you have an infinite dimensional set of conformal transformations, everything I said in the last six lectures is just a little change. So what I did is just a little change from what I had done before. So everything is clear at this point? Yes. Well, because this phi is really a tensor with lower index. So that's why this guy is downstairs. Any more questions? So I'm not writing all the indices because, in a way, by reading H and H bar, I told you what the index structure is. This guy is exactly contains the same information as how many W's and W bar. I noticed that I keep saying W and omega interchangeably. That's a childhood trauma I had. But so whenever I mean W and omega, it's the same for me. But I'll try to say W, but I forget the time. More questions? Okay. So now, very quickly, what we will see is, I'll just write it down because it follows almost line by line the same kind of analysis that we already did in higher dimensions. We want to use these conformal transformations to know how the correlation functions of primary operators look in two dimensions. And notice that unlike the case of higher dimensions where we had all these crazy tensors, mu nu and I mu nu and so on, since now everything in some sense is just a scalar from the point of view that there is no metric for taking these indices, it's just you multiply this tensor by just a number. We can, with one shot, write down the correlation function of primaries for any spin, because the spin will just be encoded in this difference of H minus H bar. Okay, so conformal invariants. So under a finite conformal transformation, the statement that the theory is conformal invariant is the statement. So now I make this transformation. That if I have a set of primary fields, let me write like that. So I have n primaries. The statement of conformal invariance is that this correlation function is the same as the correlation functions where you replace the phis with the transformed phis, but evaluated at the original point. Because in order to make a statement about symmetry, you have to compare things at the same point. And now you can extend the exercise that we did in two lectures ago. I think it's two lectures ago. About what this equation implies for the position dependence of the correlators. And remember that all that we did was very simple. We just used the fact that we know how phi tilde at W is related to phi. That's essentially what the tensor is. And we know how W is related to Z, and we just solve this equation. Essentially, what you get here is always kind of a homogeneous equation, and what you have to read out from this homogeneous equation is the Z or W dependence of the correlator. So let me write the answer for the two-point function. So notice now that we're using complex coordinates, and actually it's very convenient in two-dimensional conformal field theory to think of Z and Z bar as independent complex coordinates. So for a moment, relax the fact that Z bar usually is the complex conjugate of Z. So now we're working so in a way, Z and Z bar are unrelated, and we can make independent coordinate transformations along Z and Z bar, okay? So just solving this problem, we know that this will have to look like Z1 minus Z2 to the 2H times and this will be true as long as the dimension of H1 equals the dimension of the scaling, I don't know how to call it, the L0 eigenvalue is the same for the two operators. Otherwise, it's zero. Notice that this looks very similar to the formula we had in arbitrary dimensions, where here the difference was that we had the magnitude, and here we can separately have a z-bar dependence. And notice that this gives you the right properties, because if this guy has spin, a spin is h minus h bar, so a spin you can read off by doing a rotation in the z-plane. So you send z to e to the I phi, e to the I theta z, and it has to pick up a phase if you have a spin s to e to the I theta s. But this is exactly the phase that you pick up if you do this, because you get h minus h bar, essentially. For the three-point function, just very, I think it should be clear now what to do. So now you have the structure constant that you have to compute, and then we have these funny combinations. H2 plus H3 minus H1. Notice that the pattern is always is that you have the difference between two points, and these guys appear with a plus, and the other point appears with a minus. And now this guy, okay, in the denominator, you should be multiplied by exactly the same thing with the bars. Okay, very good. So now quickly the four-point function, and then we'll move on. And we'll see that in the four-point function there is something slightly special that happens in two dimensions. So for the four-point function, essentially you get now a function of now a single cross ratio. Remember that we said that for when you have 4 points, you have two independent cross ratios. But in two dimensions, the 4 points, because we're in two dimensions, are constrained to lie in the plane. And then, in fact, the two cross ratios are not independent. And I'll write the relation between the two of them. So you have a function of the unique cross ratio, and it's in the conjugate. And then something that's fixed in a very similar way to the way this is fixed. So it's the product over all points from 1 to 4 of the distance times some numbers. These are just numbers, gamma I z. That have the property. Notice that they have to have the property that under a scale transformation, you get exactly the scaling weight on the left-hand side. So the scaling weight on the left-hand side has to equal the scaling weight on the right-hand side. So that means that you sum over j for fixed I, so fixed I, say 1, then the sum of all these numbers has to equal minus hi. And likewise, the sum has to equal that. Okay? And eta now is the cross ratio, which is Z12, Z34, which one did I choose? Z13, Z24. Now you could have said, well, I could have constructed a new cross ratio at the hat, which in fact, kind of the analog of it exists in higher dimensions, which is this, where now instead of 1, 3 here, I have 1, 4. Sorry, and then 1, 4, 2, 3. But now the point is that these two guys are not independent. You can very easily show that eta hat is just eta times 1 minus eta. Okay? So I might as well, instead of writing this as a function of eta and eta hat and its complex conjugate, I might as well just write it as a function of eta, because this guy is just related in a very simple way to this cross ratio. So any questions about this? So, yes.
The operators that you're computing with the operator, they don't have to be the same operator.
No. Okay, no. Yeah, so this. Okay, very good. Thank you. That's why, for example, here you get in general different numbers. I mean, it's 1, it's 2, it's 3, it's 8 of operator 1, it's 2 of operator 2. Yes.
Are the power correct there on the left part? Like for Z13, are the gauges correct?
Oh, yeah, sorry. This would be 1, 3, minus 2. Yes.
And below is the same for the Z bar.
Good.
Wait.
Yes.
Can you show that the operators have to be the same for the quantum number 0?
No, but what I showed is that this has to be true. It could happen if you have a theory that have two different operators with the same quantum number. So you have two operators that have the same. Yes.
You just said eta bar is eta hat.
No, eta bar is the complex conjugate.
Right, it's not eta.
No. What I was saying is that I could write here if you wanted eta and eta bar, but it's redundant because eta bar is. And actually, what we will see is that in fact this function, in conformal theory, this function eta and eta bar can be completely factorized. So you're going to get a function of eta times a function of eta bar. But okay, we will continue. More questions? Yes.
So, what's the point of an eta hat then?
There is no point. So that's the argument. In higher dimensions, there is a point. Okay. Because eta bar, eta hat is really an independent cross ratio, an independent coordinate that you have to keep track of. But in two dimensions, it's not. But I have to show you that, in fact, it's really not independent. More questions? OK, so now. What I want to discuss is further constraints that conformal symmetry will give us on the correlation function, the two-dimensional conformal field theory. And what we're going to use is a very general technology that follows whenever you have a conserved global symmetry, which are called word identities. Have you seen this in your field theory course? No? Okay. So I'll discuss what word identities imply for correlation functions in a general setup. Tell them in a general setup because I think it's useful, because whatever I'm going to say is for the same price you can do it in any dimension. And then we will specialize to two dimensions where we will see what the consequences will be. So what I want to study now is what's called word identities. For correlation functions. Okay. So let's consider, and I'm going to use a path integral language, which is the usual one that we study field theory in higher dimensions. So we're going to define the path integral C of J as an integral over a whole set of fields. This bar phi is a collection of fields. I'm not writing indices, but it could be a Gates field, a scalar. I mean, I've used that kind of notation before. Times e to the I, S is the action, is a local action of the fields phi. And allow myself to put a source for the field. So that just means that I have So this is kind of the generating functional of all correlation functions, because in principle I can get any, if I knew how to do this integral, I would get any correlation function just by taking derivatives with respect to the source. J is the source, it's called the source. Because by differentiating with it, I induce an insertion of the field phi I. And now we just make a, what seems a bit dumb, with a trivial change of coordinates. This, after all, is just an integral, right? It's a complicated integral because you're integrating over an infinite number of variables. But all I'm doing now is just doing a change of variables, phi, into phi plus delta phi. So a small change of coordinates in the variable of integration. Such that d phi is invariant. And then we have the delta. So let's compute the variation of z of j under this change of coordinates. So I have d phi d to the s phi plus dy. Okay, I'm not going to write the argument here. And here what you get is, essentially I have to vary here the exponential. So I have to vary the action, and I have to vary the source term. So what this gives us is the integral of, and here it's important that, have d for, okay, doesn't matter the dimension, dx, the variation of the action with respect to the field, plus j. If I vary this with respect to the field, I just get j back. Times delta phi. So I just essentially did the variation of this exponential, so that gives you the exponential times the variation of the what appears in the exponent. And now, in order to get something interesting, I want to write down correlation functions. So what I can do is take.
Power. D phi is invariant under that change of coordinates.
So what I'm saying is that when you have an integral like dx f of x, and you integrate over all space, x is a dummy variable. I could have called it y, and the integral would not have changed. It's just listed now. Very good. So now what I want to do is I want to differentiate this with respect to the source n times, because I want to bring down this field phi. So what I want to do is take the derivative with respect to of n fields. So let's do that. So let me write it and then we'll explain. So we get d phi. Oh, and then at the end of the day, I'm going to put j to 0. Okay? So I do all the derivatives and then I evaluate the path integral at j equals 0. That's a trick that you've done before to construct correlation functions of operators by respect to the source. Write this as d phi e to the s. Now I have d for x or dx. I think I missed an I somewhere. I guess I need an I here. Right? Because I'm bringing down the exponential. So actually, I think it's everywhere. My eyes might be running in loops a little bit, so don't confront them completely. So let me write it and then we'll start explaining. Plus
phi x1, phi x2, and now I have a delta function here. Okay. So what's going on here? So I'm doing a derivative with respect to J. So this first term, essentially, is the term where I differentiate n times J that appears here. Okay. So that means that, so I look first at this term. If I differentiate with respect to J n times, I bring down n phi's. Okay. So I have ds d phi times the derivative of phi of x1, phi to ds n. So this is this formula. And the second term is this term. So now I vary this times this, and I differentiate n times with respect to j. So I have this guy is named j, so that gives me a delta function, derivative of j. Okay, sorry. Which is this term. And then you have to differentiate. You still have n minus 1 derivatives to take. And that brings down n minus 1 fields. Okay. Notice that this term has n fields, and this term has n minus 1 fields. Because one of them, in the derivative, didn't act on the exponential, but acted here on the derivative of the delta function. Is this clear? Okay, this is like that. And one way you can now think about this equation. So you know that there is a way of going between the path integral language, where you have a correlation function of a set of operators, of fields, to a time ordered product of operators in the usual canonical quantization picture. Is this something you've seen? I mean, you must have seen formulas like is the same as the vacuum expectation value of the time ordered product of fields. In fact, operators. So, you know, this kind of thing. So now I want to think of this expression in terms of time order product. So I didn't hear that you haven't seen this, so I assume that this is at least you have some familiarity with this. And now, so let's rewrite that using this language. So what I get here is the vacuum expectation value is the time order product of the variation of the action with respect to phi of x times phi of x1, phi of xn. This plus the term with n minus 1 phi's, so you get the time order product of phi of x1. You get a delta function like that, phi of xn equals 0, okay? So this is one kind of simple relation that you get just by doing a change of variables in the path integral. And this kind of general result that you get by doing this change of variables, these are called the Schwinger Dyson equations. And now what we want to do is essentially use the Schwinger Dyson equations in the framework when we have a symmetry. But maybe just to maybe elaborate on what this is telling us. So what this equation is telling us is that, in particular, it says that if you look at this object,
this correlation function. It vanishes if x is different from any of the endpoints. Okay? Why is this useful? I mean, what is this object? What does the variation of the action with respect to the fundamental fields of the theory give you? The equations of motion. So what this equation tells you is something very nice. It tells you that if the equations of motion appear inside a correlation function, like that, then that correlator vanishes away from singularity, away from the position of extra operators. Okay? And this can be very powerful computation, because sometimes you're doing a computation, and inside your object, you will find that, I noticed this is the just my equations of motion. And then you know that quantity has to vanish. So just to give a very simple example, let's consider a free field. So the delta S, delta phi of x is just dx squared minus m squared phi of x. And let's look at it for the case where n equals 1, okay? So this equation tells us, essentially, that and now, I'm going to use it more generally, with allowing the delta function on the right-hand side. It tells you that so that's the kind of equation that you get. Any questions about this? Okay, so the first point is that by this manipulation, what we've shown is that this particular correlation function, when you vary the action with respect to the correlation function involving the variation of the action with respect to the fields times any bunch of fields, vanishes away from the location of the other fields. And the slogan is that the equations of motion are satisfied inside the correlation functions, okay? Which is this statement. Yes?
The set of all of this.
List it?
Yes.
So now let's consider a theory that has a global symmetry. By Noether's theorem, it means that you have a conserved current. By Noether's theorem, okay. Do you want to write all of this? So let me remind you a little bit how this works. So remember that if I have a variation, that the variation of the Lagrangian, so this is a formula that you've seen before, but let me just write it for completeness, is the variation where you vary with respect to the derivative of the fields times the variation of phi of x plus okay. So that if you just make a give you Lagrangian and I ask you to do a variation with respect to phi, you always get this. If you have a a symmetry, it means that the variation of the action, well, typically has to vanish, or it can be a total derivative, okay? It means that this can be, in general, something like d mu, k mu. So from this, I can define an object, which is the current, which is the guy in the parentheses, essentially. Notice that this is the formula that we already wrote earlier when we were talking about Noether's definition for the stress tensor, minus k mu. And what this equation says is that, just by trivially rewriting this into that, it says that a mu j mu equals minus ds d phi of x delta phi of x. So all I've done is identify the pieces. So this guy is a total derivative. So identify everyone that we multiplied by the derivative with this current J. And what we've concluded is that the divergence of that current is proportional to delta S delta phi. And the statement that it is a symmetry, which was this statement, tells us that this current is conserved if you use the equations of motion. So if you use the equations of motion, delta S delta phi is zero. It's the definition of what the equations of motion are. So the J mu is conserved using equations of motion. And you've seen exercises in your field theory course before where you're asked to show that given another current for a particular global symmetry, that current is conserved if you use the equations of motion. So this is the statement here. So now what I'll do is I'll just use this formula. I'll use this formula here. So notice that here I have precisely delta S delta phi, the variation of the action with respect to the field. And here we're after the formula that tells us that the divergence of the current is proportional to delta S delta phi. So I can essentially replace here this object by the derivative of the current. Okay? So let's see what this gives us. Let's see which blackboards I have to start. This one is not very... crucial right now, so. So by just using this equation into this master formula, the Schwinger-Dyson equation, what we get is the derivative, the divergence of the time order product of a correlation function, so you have n fields. And what you do is you insert the conserved current. So you compute the correlation function of a set of basic fields, and you enrich that correlation function by the insertion of a conserved current. This tells us, notice that what I'm doing here is essentially just multiplying this guy by delta phi, right? Delta phi of x, because this is what this formula is telling us. So now the other term will have a delta phi here. So what this is telling us is that this plus I sum over the n possible operators that appear here And now here, since I'm multiplying by the variation of phi of x, you get delta of phi of x. So this is the variation times phi of xn times delta of x minus xj. So here, well, so this guy is the jth guy, okay? Is it clear what I did here? It was very simple. I just multiplied this guy by phi of x, delta phi of x. Use the fact that delta s, delta phi is the divergence of the current. And here, the delta phi of x just gives you delta phi of x here. Yes?
What are you trying to accomplish right
now? I'm trying to relate the correlation functions of operators, which is the thing that we're after. We want to know what kind of information we can use from the fact that this formula tells us that if I compute a correlation function with the insertion of a current, I get this relation. So of course, you have to be patient and see what you mean. You said there's tons of information in this, but before getting there, I have to explain you how this is derived. Notice that what this is telling you is that the correlation function of the decision of a constructive current is related to the correlation function of the same operators times the variation of one of the fields. So it relates. So one way of saying it is that the correlation function of the conserved current with the fields know about the variation of the fields under that symmetry.
Any more questions? So now let's see in particular, okay, this equals zero. So let's see immediately. An application, let's integrate, so this is kind of the basic equation. Now let's try to systematically start extracting information out of this. So what you can do is integrate this equation over all space, which in particular means that it includes all the points. So you have n points, so x1, x2, up to xn. So I'm integrating over all the space that contains these operators. And I use the fact that this is the integral of a total derivative. And if you want, I can take a finite region here. I'm integrating over a finite region, sigma. And now I take the limit where I take this region all the way to infinity. And what we use is the fact that, well, this guy is can be written as the integral over the surface element, right? Times all the fields here, x1, xn. And now, for when you have a true symmetry, the behavior of these fields falls off very fast at infinity. So actually, this guy is zero. The first contribution is zero. And therefore, what we get is the equation that the variation, okay, let me write it in the nicest way, which is the variation of the vacuum expectation value of the time order product of phi of x1, phi of xn, which is nothing but the sum. So you have to, if you have to do the variation of this, you have to, it's like a Leibniz rule. You have to vary one field after the other. So you get the sum over all the fields of the time order product of phi of x1 . This has to vanish. Okay. So this tells us that if you have a symmetry, the correlation function of the operators is invariant under the symmetry transformation, which is not very surprising. But now to connect it to something that we've seen before, this guy that we derived here from this painful route is nothing but the infinitesimal version of this equation. It tells you that if you make this equation, essentially says that the infinitesimal variation of the correlation function vanishes. So it's just the infinitesimal version of this equation. Okay? Very good. I was gonna, okay, maybe I'm not gonna do that before.
This one?
Oh, yeah.
Lower it a little bit. Optimize. So maybe this, I'll do it as an exercise, which was to show, because I know some people were interested in understanding this. I want to show that, actually, by starting from this basic equation, I lost it. Oh, okay, you lost it. Okay. I want to show that from this equation, remember that if we have another theorem, we can associate with a concept part and a concept charge, Q, which is the integral over a space. So 1rd minus 1x to make it clear. So what we'll give you a problem to allow you to show that from this equation, it follows that the variation of the operator, phi of x, is given by I minus the commutator of phi of x. So a similar transformation in quantum mechanics, when you have operators in a super space, is implemented by a commutator. And this was something that maybe was mysterious earlier in the lecture, but it's nothing, this is something that you're familiar with from your quantum mechanics course when you look at the Heisenberg picture. Yes?
I didn't follow how we got from that integration into the final results.
Essentially, what I'm saying is that the first term is the integral of a total derivative, and that there is no boundary contribution. So it means that the integral of the second term has to vanish. But the integral of the second term is completely difficult to do because I'm integrating d for x upon a delta function of x minus xj, so it localizes x at xj. Okay. Anyway, so this is a parenthesis, but we will do an exercise to see that this can be derived from these word identities.
Any more questions? Yes.
Which bit is the wall identity?
Sorry?
Where is the wall identity?
The wall identity is that one. Yes. And there are still several versions. You can integrate it. You can have integrated versions of it. So that, but the most primitive one is that one. So just to iterate, what it is telling you is how to relate the correlation functions of operators with in the insertion of conserved current to vary the correlation functions of fields with operator insertions that include the variation of that field with respect to that symmetry. And as we will see in 2 minutes, this is very powerful way of calculating correlators and knowing the analytic properties. So one of the things that we will study very carefully is the analytic properties in 2 dimensions of the correlation functions of primary operators. More questions? So this probably was a bit painful, but I think it's kind of something that if you don't see it in this course, you will not see it this year. And it's kind of one of the basic tools out there in field theory. And hopefully, well, you'll use it again. I mean, you'll definitely use it again. It appears all over the place. Okay, so now we want to have this general discussion that it's hopefully useful for a general theory. Now let's go back to the two-dimensional world. And we are now ready to just directly apply this formula, the word identity for two-dimensional
conformal transformations. So let's look at conformal. These are called conformal word identities. So let me just write it and then I'll explain. So what this is telling us is that, so I'm just writing that equation again. The A of the correlation function of the stress tensor, TAB is the stress tensor. Now in this language, A and B, I don't know why I'm using A and B now, but mu nu, but now mu nu will go from 1 to 2. Times X, so capital X, and I'll tell you what this thing is. X essentially is the product of any number of operators that you like. So what I have in mind here is probably something like that. And here I'll use, I try to be consistent in the lectures of using bar phi when I'm talking about fields that we integrate in the path integral, and capital phi when we're talking about operators or composite operators. So this guy is just the product of a bunch of operators in the theory. And the first statement of the this identity. Note, remember first that the conserved current associated to conformal transformations is written in terms of the stress tensor. That's something that I really hammered in. So what this conformal word identity, one of the things that it's telling us is that this object vanishes for Z different than any of these points. Z, Z bar. Okay, I don't know how to write this, but yeah, so Z, hopefully it's clear what I mean by this. So you wish I could have made this into a complex, called this Z1, Z1 bar, but I think it's clear what I mean. So it tells us that this particular correlation function of the stress tensor times any number of operators vanishes. And now remember, that's something that I think you saw in the tutorial. We can relate, now let's use the complex coordinates. Remember that we had complex coordinates. No, this will be confusing. Okay, so let me call this and this is Z different than Z1, Zn. And now remember that we yesterday defined in two dimensions complex coordinate. So now I can relate the stress tensor written in terms of holomorphic indices is like T11 minus T22 plus 2i T12 and T Z, Z bar, which we will call T bar, Z bar. And you know why? Because it, one is holomorphic and the other one is anti-holomorphic. Minus 2i, T12. What this equation is telling us is nothing but that the correlation function of the holomorphic stress tensor with a whole bunch of operators that I capture by this capital X, which is just a random string of operators, tells us that this satisfies, is holomorphic. It satisfies the Cauchy-Riemann equation. So that means that TZX is a holomorphic function. In fact, to be more precise, it will have to be a meromorphic function, which means that this function will be regular everywhere, except that it will be allowed to have poles at the location of these other operators. Okay? So holomorphic function of that. Likewise, if I evaluate this for the other components, so mu can either be here Z or Z bar, and by now you know how to raise and lower Z and Z bars using the metric. What you get is that this object, so I'm not going to write it, is a holomorphic function of Z bar. Okay? So this is very powerful because when, in a way, if I tell you that a function is holomorphic or meromorphic, you essentially know all about the function. All that you really have to understand is the singularity structure. You need to understand the poles of that function. Okay. So let's see this in more detail. Now, remember that yesterday, so G is a function. G is a coordinate, right? So let's go back to this. So we have Tz of x is a single-valued meromorphic function of z. Notice that I'm not saying anything about the dependence of the location of these operators, that has poles at z equals zk, where zk is precisely the location of these operators. So the idea is that I'm inserting here, so I have my n operators here, phi of x1, phi of x, okay, let's call it z1. And here I have phi of zn. And if you wish, I probe this ensemble of operators by inserting a probe, which is the stress tensor. And essentially, what we are going to be doing is fishing out for the singularities that occur when z hits any of these points. When z hits one of the operators, we'll have a singularity, a pole. And a lot of the physics of conformal field theory is actually captured by the singularities. Okay? That's why it's, in a way, easier two-dimensional conformal field theory, because many things are determined by the singularity structure. And now the point is that, so now if we approach the poles, so here, when I wrote this equation, I was strictly staying away from the insertion of the operators, right? Because I'm essentially dropping the delta function, right? So if z, which is x here, is far away from any of these points, this guy is zero. So now what I want to do is take t and bring it close to the insertion operator. And now I will not be able anymore to neglect the left-hand side because I'm localizing onto the singularity. But the point is that the information about the singularity is completely determined by this guy. But this guy is nothing but the information about delta phi is telling us how phi transforms under a conformal transformation. That's what delta phi is. Delta phi is the infinitesimal transformation of the field under the associated symmetry. So this means that we have these poles. So, and the order of the pole. So just so that everyone is on the same page, the order of the pole is you have a function that has a pole at, say, z equals zk. It's a function that near zk looks like this, with some power here, L. And the order of the pole is this L. So order of the pole is L. So what this equation is telling us is that the order of the pole and the residue And the residue essentially, okay, and the residue R, the residue is defined as the coefficient of the pole, is completely determined. By the conformal transformation properties of my operators, phi of z. Is this clear, this statement? So by staying away from all the other operators, we determine that the function is holomorphic, and by colliding, by approaching the stress tensor to the operator's insertions, we determine the singularities. Yes.
This X is made up of general operators, right?
Yes.
And we're using the word identities, which come from like, the word identities on the board there. Like you talk about the like, fundamental fields.
Yeah. So that's why. Yes, but. So I did this for, because in usual field theories, you have, you deal with the Lagrangian. But at the end of the road, after all this painful derivation, you can just formulate the statement of a word identity as an operator identity without referring to microscopic field in the Lagrangian. Of course, the way I derive it is using the path integral.
Of your fields and products of your fields, it still works, right?
Yeah. Yeah, sure. The only thing that will change is that if you have derivatives of operator of fundamental fields, of course the transformation properties change. It's like, you know, remember that I said that the operators that transform very simply are the primaries. The descendants, okay, they transform simply, but it's a bit more complicated. So if I give you an operator which is a descendant, which is kind of a, something that you construct from the basic operator, all that you have to do is just plug in here its corresponding transformation property.
All your, like, little files.
Yes. So at the end of the day, the conformal word identity in an abstract conformal field theory is essentially this statement where this bar phi's, you can turn it into capital phi's, and this is any operator. But I wanted to do it this way because that's the way in which, anyway, is usually seen and derived in using pattern. Any more questions? Let's see. I should get into this now, or maybe I should. Something else I should say, and that, but maybe that I'll leave as a this is a nice exercise. So notice that we know a lot about this function. Essentially, listed all its properties. One last thing that we impose on this function is that this function is non-singular at infinity. So remember that yesterday we discussed the fact that you have vector fields in the plane, and we required, or we studied vector fields that were non-singular on the Riemann sphere. Here we can do exactly an analogous thing for the stress tensor. What we're going to require is that the stress tensor is non-singular at the North Pole, as long as there is an operator at the North Pole. Of course, if there is an operator there, by this statement, you have a singularity. But if there is no operator over there, we require that this function is smooth at the North Pole. And maybe that's a nice exercise for you to check. This will require that dz times x, and this is kind of an asymptotic behavior, goes like, scales like 1 over z to the 4th as z goes to infinity. So we have a lot of information about this function. We know its pole structure, we know its asymptotic behavior, and that's why we can make progress. Very good. More?
Sorry?
Why is it porn?
Well, that's the content of the edit. Okay. It's not unrelated to the fact. What was the H for T? So T has how many indices? Okay, so it has H equals 2. And 4 is 2 times 2, but how you get 4 from 2 plus 2, that's something that you have to work out a little bit. It's very similar to the analysis I did for the vector fields of going from the vector field here to the vector field here and seeing how the vector field changes. More questions? Okay, one more thing. So now, something that I want to show you is how we can fish out the conformal transformation properties of any operator from the correlation function of the stress tensor with that operator. Okay? This will be a direct consequence of this statement that the correlation function of the current with an operator knows somehow about the variation of that operator under the associated symmetry. So let's write an integrated version of the word identity now. I don't think I need this anymore. So now I get, I take the conformal word identity and just integrate it. So this is, so now I make a infinitesimal conformal transformation. Okay. Of the type that we were discussing yesterday. And this equals the sum, what letter did I use? J. Okay, so generically, just the variation under a conformal transformation, under the associated conformal transformation of this correlation function. Okay? So, in particular, if x is phi of z1 bar, phi zn, zn bar, then this delta epsilon of x is nothing but the sum from j equals 1 to n of the correlation function of phi, and now delta epsilon phi zj, z bar j, phi zn, okay. And notice here that this guy is there because, well, that's like the conserved current associated to a particular conformal transformation. You multiply the stress tensor with the corresponding conformal vector field, as we saw earlier. And now I do the following trick. Maybe I will not show in all glory all the details, but I have to specify what region I'm integrating here. So here what I'll do is I'll pick a region. Well, first of all, let me use the following identity. This is just a Stokes theorem, but let me just write it very explicitly. So if you have an integral over some region
M. Okay. Of the divergence of some function in two dimensions. This is the same as the integral over the boundary. So this is the boundary of M times dz mu f mu. Okay? So that's something that in some version you've seen before, just the divergence theorem. And if you want to write in glory detail in terms of on complex coordinates, what you have is the integral over the boundary of the region. So it's kind of a contour integral now. Contour integrals will be important objects from now on, essentially. Because we will essentially be using this kind of contour integrals to evaluate correlation functions. So here I'm just writing in all glorious detail what is the statement of the Stokes theorem, essentially, in two dimensions. So now what I do is I integrate, I use that in this equation. Okay? What happened to the eraser? And I'll stop soon because I like this. I like everything. No, I don't like this one. Okay. So now let's apply it to this equation. Okay? Which this was nothing but the word identity, okay? The integrated version of the word identity where I integrate everything over some region. And now I choose my region to be a region that encloses all my endpoints of the N operators, okay? So what this equation is telling us is that the variation under a conformal transformation of a correlator is the integral over this contour C, because I can replace the integral over this domain by, because here I have a divergence, right? So I can replace that by an integral over a contour dz of epsilon z times dz times x, okay? So this is yet another way of expressing the fact that knowing how the correlator, the stress tensor with any set of operators tells us how that correlator transforms under conformal transformation. Later on, we will be studying something that is important in conformal filter, which is the operator product expansion, which essentially tells you how to replace the product of two operators as they approach each other by a linear combination of other operators. And that's something very intuitive, because if you have two points that approach each other and you look from very, very far, it looks like a fuzzy point. So the OP essentially is a statement about how you can replace the product of two operators as they close approach together by a composite operator, a sum of composite operators, okay? So not now, but in tomorrow's lecture, we'll tie up how this gives us very strong relations about what kind of, I mean, and a picture we can have for that is this. You have two operators, O1 and O2. They approach each other, and then you get a whole bunch of operators coming out, okay? And essentially, this conformal word identity is giving an information about what kind of operators, okay, can appear in the fusion of two basic operators. Okay? If now, instead of using this, of having chosen this region, I choose a region where I only enclose, so this is one important formula. Another trivial formula that follows from this is that now choose my region of integration to enclose just a particular operator, say ZJ. then essentially you get that the variation, or another way of saying it, just to just choose X to be one operator, it tells you the variation of that operator. Say it's at Z1 bar, is the contour integral of dz, epsilon z, dz times phi z1 bar, where again, here this contour C prime is a contour that encircles the insertion of the operator, okay? So now let me just conclude, I'll conclude with, the, with this statement. So remember that before I said that one consequence of the conformal word identity was the fact that the variation of the correlation functions and the conformal transformation vanished. And that was, as I said, this is the infinitesimal version of the conformal relation that tells us how the correlators of phi at x are related to the correlators of phi tilde at x. And if you apply, okay, no. So if you do this, if you apply the general result for a global conformal transformation, so what I'm going to write now, remember that one of the things that I needed in order to discard the boundary term when I integrated this. So just very briefly, remember that the way we derived that was that I integrated this over all space-time. And I said that the behavior of infinity, if it falls off sufficiently fast, I can discard this, and I just get that the variation of the correlator has to vanish. This is also, this is something that is true now in two dimensions in a conformal field theory, not for any conformal transformation. The point is that for there are conformal transformations for which the boundary term will not be, cannot be dropped. But for the ones that can be dropped, and you can check it just explicitly, are for the global conformal transformation. So remember, these were the ones that are globally defined on the Riemann sphere. And they had this form of Z goes into W for these ones, the fall off of the total derivative goes to zero sufficiently fast that it doesn't contribute, and then we have that the variation of phi of z1 bar with respect to the associated transformation. So here, this is only true for very specific transformations now in two dimensions, which are the global ones. Now, by essentially, there are three basic transformations that we have there. We had L0, remember? We had L0, sorry, L0 and L0 is the same thing. So L0, L1, and L-1. And using the fact that under remember that we define the notion of a quasi-primary operator. These are operators that transform nicely under global conformal transformations. And this transformed like that. So there is a piece which is just a translation. So the vector field times the derivative times the part that knows about the scaling dimension. So this equation tells us that the sum, so let's look at first for L-1. L-1 essentially is like a translation. Because remember that Ln is z to the n plus 1. So L-1 is just ddz, which is just a translation. What this is telling us, this equation applied to L-1, is telling us that ddzi, acting on this beast, where I goes from 1 to n, vanishes. L0 tells us that sum from 1 to n of zi Wi. This is, remember that this is the definition of the L0 vector field plus its conformal dimension of this equals 0. And the final one, which is the weird one, is something that's quadratic in the coordinate. Can people see down here? I don't know. But you have that this is zeta square dzi plus 2zi hi. And this equals 0. And just to connect with things we've done before, another point is that this is the statement that the correlation function is invariant under global conformal transformations. And now you can solve these equations, and what you will precisely find is the things that I erased already. But essentially, notice that before we found what is the position dependence of correlation functions by imposing conformal symmetry, the finite piece of conformal symmetry, the finite transformation. And what this set of differential equations is telling you is reproducing exactly that answer from this differential equation point of view. So in particular, it means that by looking at this, you will find that if you have more than 4 points, by solving this equation, you'll find that the cross ratio is annihilated by this operator, essentially, okay, by this operator. And that's another way in which you could have discovered, kind of very systematically, being very careful, the cross ratios. So this is another way of determining the position dependence of correlation functions just by using the word identities. So remember that the buzzword here is word identities, and the word identities precisely determines for you the dependence of the correlators on positions. Okay? And tomorrow we will discuss the very interesting effects that the non-globally defined transformations give you on correlation functions. So maybe I'll stop because I'm running out of time. Yeah.
True for primary operators. Quasi-primary, yes.
Yes. If it's not quasi-primary, the point is that I cannot drop the boundary term and have to keep it. And so that this equation is not quite true. But there is still an interesting equation that you get.
The way we've been doing it before.
Well, that of course assumed, to be honest, that actually also worked for quasi-primaries and primaries.
Okay, even though we sort of said it was all.
Well, they're still primaries. Is it primaries or quasi-primaries?
I think quasi-primary is a primary.
A quasi-primary? No, it's not a primary. A primary is something stronger. Well, so actually, in a way, I was cheating because I was only really using the global one, right? I was using, he made a use, I was always using scale transformations, inversion, which are the global ones. But we will see that, nevertheless, we can write down interesting operator equations for the non-global one. And we will be able to tell what the correlator of the primaries are, not only for the primary.
Okay.
Any more questions? We'll continue tomorrow.
So before you run off, we've got a quick thing about computers. Enjoy.
So sticky laptop.